On the wall of her chambers, Justice, the late beloved Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, had a line from this week's parasha, Deuteronomy 16, verse 20, Tzedek, Tzedek, Tirdof. And as our Torah had no vocalization marks that would indicate volume nor italics to indicate importance, it had its ways of emphasizing things were to repeat them very typically. So how do we translate things like Naton Titain, Tzedek Tzedek? Ambiguous, ambivalent, difficult to translate into English. I found a translation that I thought was lovely but probably problematic called that said, pursue absolute justice, which translation I'd like to consider this weekend, the ways in which Judaism understands the rule of law, the necessity for justice, the importance of judges and courts as a way, perhaps, of approximating God's justice here in the human realm. So I'll give you a little sense of the way the rabbis imagined, perhaps accurately historically, perhaps not, courts. There were various types of Sanhedrin, that's I believe probably an Aramaic word of for courts. The minor Sanhedrin was probably the most commonly used. It had, I think, 23 judges. What's interesting is that the judges themselves effectively served both as advocates and attorneys and as voters and as jury. They'd hear the testimony of the witnesses, asking the witnesses and interrogating the witnesses cleverly and expansively, actually. And then they'd split into two groups, those inclined to argue for acquittal and those inclined to convict. And they would become the advocates for each side of the vote, not lawyers. They fulfilled multiple roles, which is probably partly why you needed so many of them, lest one become sort of adamant or predisposed. They could advocate on behalf of the accused to each other. There's a sense that justice needed to be wrestled and grappled with. But what's interesting is that in the case of capital crimes, the witnesses would be the first to throw the stones. The witnesses would be the first to execute judgment. We have the principle that you need to face your witnesses in court, but theirs went even further, that the witnesses were part of the team of execution, rendering the act of witnessing to be incredibly momentous and difficult, such so that in the Babylonian tractate Sanhedrin, it describes the exacting measures through which the judges would interrogate witnesses, sometimes asking them how many leaves were on that tree under which the accused stood. Of my many passions in social justice and civic service, among the greatest that I honor and strive for is the rule of law. Having lived for 2 years in a country where rule of law was ineffective at best, a better term might be weak, but the truth was rampantly and unavoidably corrupt, I recognize that earthly rule, despite its flaws, has the potential to, at the very least, protect us from anarchy and warlordism, from preference, corruption, and bribery. And our sages knew this too. In Pirkei Avot, Rabbi Hanina, who was then a high priest, vice high priest, said, pray for the welfare of your government, for were it not for fear of it, each person would swallow their neighbor alive. And you have to recall that Jews, like the early Christians, despised the Roman government, despised authorities. They thought authority was necessarily a danger to Jewish communities, and they created laws and rules such that Jewish communities ought not inform to the civic authorities, and could be do so under penalty of death in some cases in Eastern Europe. But they understood that the alternative to the rule of law was much worse. The alternative, honestly, is the Taliban. The alternative was warlordism in Somalia. The alternative was the Book of Judges. Judges, we often translate, it's a lazy translation. They were really chieftains, if not warlords. It was a period of pre-centralized government that was nightmarish and involved quite a few intra-communal pogroms, which I think part of the reason I give this sermon is I can see that being an outcome here if the rule of law is further degraded. And we see it, you know, in school board meetings that barely contain violence. And there's a recognition in our sages and in this week's parasha that the rule of law is a very fragile thing. There are those, our tradition say in chapter 17 of this week's parasha, act presumptuously, but they're really what we might call scofflaws. People who don't follow the rulings of the court, people who disrespect the mitzvot of the Torah, people who exempt themselves from the communal obligation to share in the execution of the law. The Divrei Shaul, who is Rabbi Joseph Saul Nathanson in Poland in the 19th century, said that a scofflaw is similar to Sodomites, to the people of Sodom and Amorah, who left no room for remorse in their law. There was no place for tshuva. And this person was called the Zaken Mamre, the elder scofflaw, feels that his actions can be sanctioned by the law, or to be more accurate, that the law has no place regulating his actions, that his or her individual freedom is more important than communal cohesion and the existence of the rule of law that binds us all. And various articles have said that the single things that binds Americans together in a world and a country of pluralism and religion and ethnicity and wealth and geographic diversity is our adherence to the rule of law. That's why presidents and generals, that's their oath. And in this case, says the Divrei Shaul of a Zaken Mamre, of a scofflaw, since he is not part of society, he's not capable of tshuva. Somehow, becoming a better person, a stronger person, a more rule-abiding person are all connected. This deep necessity for courts, which, as I hinted, even Milton Friedman and libertarians of all stripes tend to acknowledge is a core duty of the American state and every state, from John Locke onward, the minimum is protection of property in courts. Our ancestors understood that. In the Midrash on this week's parasha, Rabbi Eliezer says, in a place where there is judging, there will be no further judging. But in a place where there is no judging, there will be further judging. Which is to say, awkwardly perhaps, or just sort of pithily, if justice is carried out here on earth below, there will be no further judging in heaven above. But if there's no justice below, no justice made by humankind, there will be judging by God. That God will exact retribution on us if we let the rule of law be befouled. Judges are vital. Judgment is vital. The rule of law is vital. People submitting themselves to the corporate constitution, and I mean that with the small c, not our constitution, but the constitution of a society, to obey shared rules is vital. Without it, we risk falling in off the road towards civil war. Because, note our sages in various places, Sodom and Gomorrah had judges, but they were some terrible judges. They were corrupt and amoral or immoral. So the question becomes almost one of legal training. In a world where our tradition, and I think American scholars recognize the necessity of the rule of law, that the only thing worse than tyranny is chaos to the human mind, how can you be a good judge? And I mean, this is not in the sense of being a trained judge in robes, not being an attorney with a JD, but participating in assessing judgment in a variety, in a world of multiple opinions. How do we find what is just and what is the closest approximation for, let's say, divine justice, or as the Enlightenment philosophers would say, natural law? So the Noda Be Yehuda, who was Yeheskel Landau, writing in Poland in the 18th century, notes this phrase, if I recall it's in this week's Parsha or next, the Torah is not in heaven, but has been given to humankind to study and comprehend. But here's the rub, says he. Whenever a question or issue is raised, it's a human being, not God, a human being employing finite judgment, finite knowledge, who has to render the ruling. So how is it that finite and error-prone intellect is authorized to decide such divine absolutes? As we've been joking today, you know, Zoom is an amazing technological advance that in my youth only existed in Star Trek. But it is human-made, and it collapses on us when we most need it. In the sense that all of human creation is faulty. It's not divine. I mean, that's the value of living, right? We live a finite life that has meaning because it's not perfect, that contains joy and sadness and striving, because we're not made whole. We are made to strive toward wholeness, and nowhere more so than in the execution and the discovery of justice. The Hasidic sage Simcha Bunim of Peshishka notes that, returning back to the very first phrase I started with, tzedek, tzedek tirdof, that doubling word of tzedek, which we translate as justice or righteousness or mercy or charity, is unnecessary. And as I pointed out, linguistically, it's used to make emphasis. But Simcha Bunim and other midrashists, other exegetes say, is there a just justice and an unjust justice? Indeed there is, says Reb Bunim. The Torah is telling us to be just in the pursuit of justice. Both the ends and the means by which it is obtained must be just. So that, I think, like the Nodeb B'Yehuda, gives us a sense of how to become good judges. I'm not sure that I like Ted Lasso, the show. But I was reading a review of it, and it said that what he does successfully as a character is to be more curious than judgmental, which is a psychological principle, to not be judgmental, to start with curiosity, a mindful curiosity, before we judge. And I think that's a bit what our sages are saying, that by being more curious than judgmental, by having the judges participate in the inquisition, in the inquest of justice, not just the deliberation of justice, the curiosity preceded judgment, because as the Noda Yehuda says and Simcha Bunim say, we are error prone, we are frail, we have our foibles, we are inherently imperfect, and we strive for godlike wisdom, but it's never to be ours. And so we must strive that the ends and the means be just, that we recognize the limits of our own capacity. Repeatedly in this week's parasha, we have this phrase, "V'arta hara mikirbecha," or "V'arta hara mikirb Yisrael," to burn out what's wicked, to consume, to obliterate. "V'arta" is an odd word that's used in a couple of contexts. Wickedness, which seems a kind of absolutism, which I think, you know, I would be very wary of. And as you can tell from the sermon, I'm very wary of. But is intended to drive us towards something like supreme judgment. But we're also reminded in an incredible mitzvah that even a king should carry a copy of the Torah scroll by his bedside and read from it regularly, to remind himself that there is justice, there is rule above him. Some say that's why we wear a kippah, to recognize that there is more above and around us than our own will, our own freedoms, our own desires, our own sense of righteousness and judgment. So we exist, I think our sages would tell us, in the tension between an absolute and an unwavering commitment to justice, to burn out wickedness in our midst, and a sensibility that we are frail arbiters and poor executors of such supreme justice, and that we have to be ever reminded of our imperfection, whether it's by a Mishnei Torah, a second scroll of Torah, a rewriting of the Torah that we keep by our bedside, or just the small, still voice that we are not gods. And so we are joined together in a fabric and network of mutuality by the slender threads of the rule of law.